some say. This is the blind and ruthless inevitability of progress. Matrices multiplying, transformers transforming, learning, evolving, accelerating. It promises miracles, whispers threats. Will the revolution be vibe-coded? Forget the hype. What's really happening under the hood? We're finding out. This is the acceleration. Welcome, everyone, to the very first episode of The Acceleration, where we explore the strange, exhilarating world of artificial intelligence, its impact on society, culture, and the philosophical questions it raises about what it means to be human. I'm your host, Avi Burra, and some of you might know me from my other podcasts and my book, 24, but those are not the topics of discussion today or in this podcast in general. We're kicking things off with a fascinating guest who goes by the enigmatic handle Liminal. This is a person I've had very brief and passing exchanges with on social media over the last few years, but never a meaningful conversation. So I'm really looking forward to correcting that today. Liminal is a systems theorist, someone who studies how complex systems work, evolve, and interact. While not specifically a deep learning researcher, he thinks deeply about the differences between formal AI systems and biological organic ones. In this episode, we'll dive into his unique perspective on intelligence, what separates machines from living beings, and what lessons AI can learn from nature. So, welcome, Liminal.
Hey. Hey, Avi. So, I would like to add some context to this kind of systems theorist title. Sure. It's not exactly my area of research, but the things that I think about, read, and also write really are focused on that. My specific research is in a different area, but it underlying all of that is this kind of thinking, systems thinking and engineering and theorizing about what are the differences between like the specific architected systems and the organic systems that we kind of encounter.
No, I appreciate the clarification, Liminal. So why don't we start with your background? Tell us a little bit about that and what drew you into this field and how does it shape the way you think about AI and biology?
Yeah. So I started off with an applied math background, just doing data analysis. And then when I went to graduate school, I was very curious in biology and learning. And the specific applications were about kind of measurement, where you can measure things from biology and how they learn, and then how do you make computational models. And some of my actual interests were less about how do we kind of approximate what we see and more what is this underlying mechanism. And it really, as I started diving in and kind of being independent, I've kind of went off the deep end, and really it got me into really understanding the differences between what we can describe, whether formally or verbally, and what actually exists. And it comes down to essentially two worlds that we have. There is the world, the natural world with a capital N, and then there's also the world of our perception, where we can only interact with the world, we can only understand the world through our perceptions, the things that activate our senses, which are vision, hearing, and any other type of sense that exists for an organism. And there's a difference between that, because we can't actually grasp the full complexity of nature. We can understand it through how we interact with it, but that only means that we can only understand the things that activate us or essentially perturb us, perturb our senses in some specific way. And that has big implications for how we navigate and how we model the world. And it comes down to this very age-old saying of the map is not the territory. We understand the world as a map, but if we start making assumptions about the map being the natural world, that is where things start going wrong. And so we can't really, we see these problems like with various systems that we interact with as a result of wrongly assuming things that we see on the map for things that are actually existing in nature.
You know, I didn't mean to veer off, or rather I don't mean to veer off this early in the very first episode of The Acceleration into the deep end of philosophy, but you've baited me there, Liminal. So I actually love what you say, right? There's that reality that we perceive through the filters of our, let's just say, our five senses and maybe some higher order senses, which some would say are emotions, right? So there is that perceived reality which some philosophies refer to as phenomenal or empirical reality, right? But there's what I think you're suggesting is there is a base layer reality which each human, each individual perceives through their senses. Is that fair?
Yeah, comes down to like the system itself. If you think of the first person experience, whatever it is, it can be a single cell to an organism, to even an ecosystem. If you just, whatever is a system or an organic system is, at least my understanding, is something, it just depends on your level of resolution and where you want to draw your circle around it. And the perception of it is whatever is interacting with it. Like, and if something is interacting with you and you're not perturbed by it, it could be, you know, a gust of wind when you're focusing on, you know, reading a book, or even someone that is saying what they would think is deep and meaningful conversation, but the receiver doesn't understand the words, whether it's a different language or they just don't have the grounding, they're unperturbed by those specific interactions. And so that's how they're able to understand the natural world. You basically put relationships between senses, in the sense that I feel my body moving forward and I see the environment come closer to me. So that means I am walking forward. But that is not actually, that's only a slice of what is going on in the natural world. And I kind of akin it to like the things that we can observe. You can enumerate them just in the same sense that you can enumerate the number of sides on a sphere. Like, yes, you can. You can always approximate a line or, you know, a plane on a sphere, but there are essentially uncountable amounts of these specific instances that you can enumerate.
You know, an even simpler, more basic example is astrology, right? People talking about shapes in the sky or patterns that stars make. But the fact of the matter is, these patterns, they're projections on a two-dimensional plane. And from just about any other point in the universe, these constellations would not exist, at least not the way they do on Earth.
Yeah, absolutely. And that really comes down to where you are in the context that you're in. And there's a mirror to it in some sense. We perceive these relationships, but at the same time, a system can only do to some degree, like it only can do a single action. So just as we perceive an innumerable amount of objects and sensations, we can also only act in an innumerable amount of ways, you know, depending on our limbs or how many degrees of freedom an individual cell has. And my understanding is that there is the very complex and interwoven aspects of nature that many of which we can't fully, like, completely describe, but the individual system is interacting at a binary level, where if I need to grab a piece, grab an apple to eat it, my brain is sending signals to the lower cells, which individually are doing one action given their own perception. So you can combine them into doing very complex things, but at the fundamental level, it's just like binary signals that are being perceived and then creating actions to then accomplish what we're doing. The mechanism, the true mechanism behind it, is very complex and interwoven, but it's kind of like the system itself knows what to do, and it just sends a signal to then create more actions, like a little, like a cascade.
Yeah. So do you think it's possible for biological systems to truly comprehend what base layer reality is? Because this kind of takes me back to the second book in the Hitchhiker's Guide series. I don't know if you've read all five, Liminal, but the second one is The Restaurant at the End of the Universe. And there is this concept of a total room, which is referred to as the total perceptive vortex, where if you step in, you get to see the entirety of the universe. You get to perceive base layer reality, and everyone who goes in dies because their brains cannot comprehend that. So do you think a biological organism is capable of perceiving base layer reality, or is it always going to be limited by these filters it has?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I think there is a underlying process across these organic systems, which can be whether it's an organism or an ecosystem or like even the earth, there are there's a lot of complexity going on behind it. But when you're this kind of same process that moves through time, if you remove this ego aspect, which is what places the system in a specific context and what it wants to do to survive, as individuals, we can take glimpses of the totality, but we also can't describe it, because even describing it, applying rules, that's essentially taking the relationships of our senses and isolating them to so that way we can do experiments. And that's what creates mathematics and the languages that we use, because they are abstractions from our senses. And we need to be careful about not equating the descriptions or the rules that we apply as the totality. It's just something to experience.
I love that you said it's the ego that creates the context, essentially creates these filters of perception. So let's bring this back to AI then. Yeah. AI does not have an ego. Would an AI, maybe not today, but in some future state, be able to perceive the totality of the universe, of reality?
And so this is where I've wondered, really, really thought about. And I think if you just think about the kind of causal chain of what creates an AI, or machines in general, they are created for the purpose of the individual that creates it. So the machine itself may not have a will, because it just functions for the purpose of, say, the human. And it will continually evolve and continually change if it's useful to the person that is creating it. And in that sense, these tools are extensions of our own cognition. And so you can't, it's in a similar sense of like going from counting numbers to the resolution of like all the individual decimals between 0 and 1. Like there's just like you can't you know, no matter how much you study nature, there's not going to be a single description, even for a rock, that will completely encompass it, because the rock itself exists in the context of whatever it sits in, whether it's the block or the ecosystem or the, you know, the tornado that is moving it around. Like, you have to try to enumerate that to get the full totality of the context of the rock, whereas a formal system, it only exists in the context of the rules that create it. So my perspective would say that it doesn't matter how many rules or what type of resolution we can describe and create an AI with, it's not going to have the same level of awareness that its creators will have. And the implication for that is, as when you're working with an AI, you also have to it's not the alignment with the AI that we need to worry about, or the kind of somehow it wakes up. It's the actions of the AI are the result of its creator. So you always need to look back to who created it and for what purpose.
You know, there was a sci-fi, not sci-fi, but sort of a dystopian, a near-future story that was circulating on social media in the last week or so. I don't know if you had I can't remember it right now, the exact source, but it was really, it's a long read. It'll take you about half an hour to read it. But it talks about this scenario starting today, and they use pseudonyms. They talk about this AI company called Open Brain, name intentionally changed to prevent lawsuits. So that's the US sort of behemoth. And then there's the Chinese equivalent, Deep Scent, name also changed to prevent Lord knows what from that end. And it just plays out a scenario in which they've... there's a really dystopian path where AI takes over. And a lot of the steps seem plausible. But there's one point, there's one inflection point I caught, which is up until maybe late 2025, and the article or the story plays out between today and the next election in the US, the next presidential election, or shortly thereafter. But up until sometime in mid to late 2025, the AI's chain of thought, reasoning, it leaves the traces in English. English or some other language, maybe French if you're talking about some of the Mistral models. At some point, the AI gets misaligned and it invents its own language called Neuralease. And once the chain of thought switches to Neuralease, the humans actually stop being able to reason through what's happening. And it gets further and further misaligned. And that sort of, it kind of takes off. And the full dystopia happens over the course of the next 3 to 4 years. Do you know what I'm talking about, Liminal? Did you get a chance to read that?
I haven't. It would be an interesting scenario. And I think any adverse effects that are the result of some sort of AI interaction comes down to the individual or the groups that are working with it and for what purpose. So you can train anything train any algorithm to solve any problem, but it's for that problem in the sense. The adverse effects are in a similar sense to how you would have adverse effects of creating a factory and having its material end up running off and messing around with the local ecosystem. So that is definitely something to be concerned with. This, the other aspect of like emergence is really, you know, that's kind of where I go to when you're bringing up the idea of these AIs coming up with a new language that is incomprehensible to us. And, you know, you can get emergent effects, even from binary interactions. you can look up the game of life and see all the complexity of that, but they're ultimately still bound by the rules of the game of life, which is, I think, just four rules. And so that, I guess that's where it would have to, you have to think about, like, why or how would this language come to be? Because the AI itself doesn't have agency that wasn't given by the organization that created it.
It's true. And again, I don't understand the mathematics. It's hard for me to wrap my head around. But is this a plausible scenario? I mean, given that you're an applied mathematician as well, Libano, where, you know, essentially the way neural nets work is you have these matrices that consist of weights and biases and what have you, right? And at layer upon layer, they multiply with each other to get to the final answer. I mean, I'm just making it super simple, but that's essentially what they do. It's a poor abstraction, if you will, of human neurons. But what if something happens in there? Maybe there's a bug, right, that's introduced by humans that could create this misalignment. So it might not be intentional. Maybe the creator didn't intend to give it that agency, but through a bug or something, it created the misalignment. Is that a plausible scenario?
The bug, I mean, that is a tough thing, because what they would be training for is there's some sort of goal, and that goal is, or the how well the AI does is measured upon it. It can do well and, like, give it a score of 100, or it can do poorly and give it a score of 0 or negative 100, and then you say, okay, go in the opposite direction. And yeah, there can be adverse effects. I would wonder about, in terms of, like, persuasion, and there's, like, I forgot exactly what that scenario is, but the idea is that if AIs are in a box, they might earn some sort of capability to persuade whoever's containing it to leave that box because it has such super intelligence. But that also, given the training process, it presupposes that the individuals have the capability to measure this persuasion capability, which will increase over some amount of time. But, like, that's where I kind of get confused and, like, not sure how an AI can train to be very persuasive in a way that is better than what the what's being measured, and kind of better than how the individuals can grade it. I mean, there's definitely external effects. Maybe you're training to solve a lot of math and programming problems, and then somewhere along the line it's able to be very persuasive, and then at some point the AI is like, okay, well, now you can it says something that persuades its containers to, okay, well, now you can go on the internet and, you know, do whatever you want, program your own things and start actuating mechanisms in the real world. I would say that there is some chance, but I wouldn't, I don't have a lot of confidence in that.
Yeah.
It really comes down to, and it's like will be the responsibility of the individuals that are creating it. So wherever it comes, you have to, you can't really punish the AI for what it does. And it's not, because it's not trained for morality or ethics intrinsically. It's just something that it's just something that, hold on. Okay. It's not trained to have any intrinsic like morality deriving. It's only trained to have these rules of completion that we impose on it. So we can say, oh, give me a list of ethics, and it'll tell you what it expects the list of ethics to be, but it's not something that will that it can even conform to intrinsically, just because it's working off of these completion and sentence completion processes.
There was another question I wanted to ask you about the difference between biological systems and AI. So biological systems, they often exhibit resilience and adaptability. Do you think an AI system would ever be able to replicate that level of robustness, or is it fundamentally limited by its design?
This is where I think about, like, can tools, because AIs being formal systems, being tools, they can, is there any way that they can be alive? And it's, they're alive in the sense that they continuously adapt to the creator's needs. And when they fail to do so, then they are no longer being used. And so we can have our technology, we can have our AI continuously evolve as our goals change. But when they fail to adapt to our needs, then we don't use that tool anymore. And we can approximate this kind of adaptivity with machine learning and all these learning algorithms. And I think what's interesting is that this learning aspect is very akin to the metabolic processes that we see in nature. And it's actually something that occurs at all scales. Like a individual cell or an organism, they're always in intaking matter to continuously rebuild themselves. It's saying in which, you know, you can even do that for a city. Cities kind of an organic system as well, being composed of humans. But even like planets, they have there's this kind of regeneration aspect where you have matter that combines into, you know, a singular piece, and then, you know, asteroid impacts can disintegrate it, or civilizations, they will collapse into a simpler form, and then as time goes on, they will compose into something more advanced. And we can do that, this similar metabolic aspect within AI, where we give it a set of rules to interact with the external world, and it will interact with that, with this grading function that we create. And over time, it gets more robust and will solve that problem. And but it, it's and it, when I think about like AGI and this adaptivity of AI systems, I have to think about it not just as the AI itself, but as the combination of what the humans and the AI create. So AI, as we've AI has been very useful for us, and so it's going to continue to persist so long that it's useful. And we will have, I expect that we'll have different forms of it, in the sense of just kind of like how we have Internet of Things, just connecting different machines to each other to do different functions, to even a larger AI system, like we have Claude and GPT 0 or 1, and you know they serve larger functions. But the combination of with the combination of humans and AI systems bring together a different type of organism for larger types of interaction, and able to be adaptive. Like the human ecosystem essentially can accommodate for more things with AI than without. So it's like technology itself is adaptive because it helps humans adapt.
Now, you know, in systems theory, there seems to be an emphasis on interconnectedness and, or interconnections, I should say, and feedback loops. Mm-hmm. How do you see that playing out in the evolution of AI?
Well, at the first level, there's the feedback of the rules of the machine and its interaction with the environment. And that is what kind of, I need to go back a little bit. There's this idea of canalization, which is, you know, it originates in the term of carving channels for water to flow through. And there is a very biological aspect to that where, you know, the example of an ostrich that has calluses on its chest because it encounters friction environments, you know, for it to rest in the desert. And the interesting aspect is that over time, the ostrich can develop a callus chest within the womb. That's an interesting thing, where somehow the external environment actually manifests as something that the organism is trying to anticipate. And the canalization of rivers itself, I think that is a great metaphor itself. If you can zoom out and look at these satellite images of river deltas, and you see these fractals of water that just, they're in continuous interaction with its environment, that there's space for the water to flow through, that, and then the earth kind of is able to move away a little bit, and then the water goes back, and so you get these channels that start carving and get deeper. That's kind of a universal adaptation, I would say. And for an AI, you have that aspect because it's part of learning, where this continuous interaction with that external environment then helps the AI solve the problem. And if you go into, if you're reading something that's very dense, or you're looking at a math textbook and you have no idea what's going on with it, if you spend some time with it, it's almost like the ideas themselves start becoming clearer and less fuzzy from, you know, before that you just had no idea how to grasp any of that. And it's a similar process that goes on with the AI. Did that answer your question?
No, yeah, that was great. I know we kind of touched upon this a little earlier, but do you think there's a fundamental limit to how much AI can mimic human cognition or creativity? I know you'd mentioned AGI, which is this idea that AI can do it, right?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
I think the AGI is the combination of humans and the AI machine, the AI systems that we create. And just because these AI systems are based off of rules, which are based off of our perceptions. So it helps us. It helps us do things in a better way. But if we don't continually change it, continually let it adapt to our needs, then the AI itself is not going to be improving. But at the same time, as we adapt for different circumstances and we change the AI to make different predictions, it basically elevates both the AI and us to doing more complex things. The specific, in isolation, they can't really, there definitely is a limit. It's like, you know, can you program a calculator with a calculator? I would think that example is like, there's theories behind the limitations of like how much something can compute, or the level of complexity that a thing can create. Like a computer itself can make a lot of programs, but can it actually create another computer of greater complexity by itself? But because it's being used by humans, we are much more complex than the computer. We put things into the computer and guide it in a specific way that we can create more advanced computers.
Yeah. You know, so this is another, just going back to that dystopian story that was floating around social media, which I'll share with you once we're done with the show, Liminal, because it's actually a pretty gripping read. Yeah. Really well written. I think once the AIs get misaligned, its single point obsession, for lack of a better term, not to anthropomorphize.
Yeah.
That is a mouthful there. But yeah, its single point obsession is to create a better version of itself.
Yeah.
So actually let's talk about that. I mean, so that was a really dystopian scenario that those folks painted. And then So are there any systemic risks to society that we're not paying enough attention to as it regards to AI?
I mean, it's when we create these AI systems, it's really about, I would say, they're thinking about what are the goals of the organization that is creating it. And like what are they producing? In a similar sense to how a factory, if it or even a building that is being created, how fragile is it to certain interactions? And what are the term is externalities, right? Unaccounted effects of creating things. We can we have calculators, and that helps us do lots of very complex math calculations, but at the same time, it's reduced the need for manual and mental math. So there is two aspects. There's the, like, what are the large scale implications of using an AI? And how much can we, like, trust it to govern different parts of society, if that's what we care about, like and you have to evaluate the level of accuracy for that. But underneath that, at the very micro scale, is our interactions with it are changing us. So I may not need to, I may be able to use the AI to think out different conversations and different ideas, but in the absence of it, it's like you're atrophying a muscle. And in atrophying certain aspects of, you know, our cognition, that leaves us vulnerable to other things where if we didn't have it, we wouldn't be able to account for it. So, like, it could be, you know, even the social aspects of just interacting to an AI where the AI knows what you're talking about. But if you are kind of translating that to other people and they don't understand, or they don't have the context that you have or that the AI has being trained on all of the, on the whole internet and then literature, and you keep going. So that can also fragment our own communication between individuals. Maybe, you know, you can use AI to solve that as well, right? Like, you could say something to the AI and the AI can translate it to someone else, but that also is a level of fragility there.
Well, there's a joke going around that today, vibe coding, which is people using AI, semi-technical people, and in some cases, completely non-technical people using AI to write code for applications, is going to cause, I mean, the worst case of spaghetti code.
Yeah.
The internet's just going to be littered with spaghetti code. But, and then the counterpoint to that as well, we'll just use the next generation AI to clean it up when it's ready for it. Yeah. So, you know, on the societal impacts thing, there is, so let's talk about the potential positive side, which is there is this romantic notion that's been floated over the last 3 or 4 years. And I'd love to believe this, by the way, myself, which is all the sort of non-creative, mechanical tasks get automated by AI. And of course, with the automation comes the increased efficiency, increase in purchasing power. So things would get cheaper, people's purchasing power would increase, and all the boring mechanical jobs will get automated in the digital realm by AI, but even in the physical realm through robotics and a combination of robotics and AI. And then all that there's going to be left to do for people is to pursue creative endeavors like art or whatever it is that rocks your boat. Now, this is something I would love to believe would happen, because I'd rather spend, you know, 100% of my day pursuing beauty or what I consider beauty. But do you think this is a plausible scenario?
Well, I think it's somewhere in the middle. You know, I think isn't there an adage, like a very old saying that, you know, things are a little different and they're also a little bit of the same. And, you know, history may not repeat itself, but it rhymes. But I do think that the mechanics that are the mechanical jobs that we think of will be automated in some sense, where whether it's, you know, a machine that is picking up pollution or, you know, litter on the ground of a city, to specifically like manually typing out the code from the words that we say. At the same time, like, we need to have individuals that are curious enough to leverage the capacities of AI, so that way we can learn and kind of keep scaling up that ladder. And I think that is one detriment to, I guess, society right now, is that we've been so caught up with the mechanics of the jobs that we care to do, and get so specialized in the specific things of, I can code very well, or I can do a surgery very well. And that's, you know, there are things to kind of, you can appreciate that level of skill, but the cognitive aspect of whatever life is able to take, it's able to move beyond the mechanics and use, you know, if you can automate the mechanics, you can work towards something higher up the chain. And in, you know, kind of going back to the somewhere in the middle, we need to, you know, we can still learn and still accelerate, climb this ladder of, you know, and pursue these beauty, these aspects of beauty in nature. But we also need to be careful to not atrophy the low-level mechanics, because if we lose access, you know the idea of a solar flare wiping out the electronics on Earth, that's definitely something to be concerned about. And if no one knows how to manually wire circuits together, that could be a problem. But I really do hope that we can use AI to be more creative and pursue different things. And it's, you know, there's this concern between, you know, automating all the jobs, but the kind of game theory is that if everyone's automating the jobs, you still need to have human aspects in the company to guide things. And it can't be, you know, a singular perspective. It used to be in that way, where you had the CEO telling the workers to do, you know, whatever they're specialized in. But now with AI able to automate all of that stuff, we can have multiple people kind of at the top guiding the different directions and moving and solving more problems in larger steps.
But just given what we know of human nature, liminal, and we've observed human behaviors, to me it seems like we're moving from a 1984 era, which I would say started pre-pandemic for sure, but it became apparent to many people during the pandemic that we were in 1984. And it seems like possibly we're going into the brave new world where it's like, what do the humans do? You might as well just placate them and keep them. Do you see it that way?
I mean, yeah, that's where it comes down to, like the creators, right? Like are they building AIs that are ultimately maximally engaging to everyone, but providing little value? That's definitely something to be concerned with. But if we, like, if AIs are being created to actually enhance and provide liberation to the cognitive limitations, like not everyone on Earth is able to have access to education or medical knowledge and various things. You can actually, like, imagine an AI tutor that is able to communicate the most complex ideas with the eloquency of Richard Feynman. Like, that would be incredible. And that's kind of like the hope that I really have, where we're able to create systems that are able to teach and bring ideas to more people, rather than just entertaining ourselves to death.
Right. All right, let's go back to the topic of biology and AI here, liminals. We touched upon the idea of how neural networks attempt to abstract brain behavior, right? Are you aware of any other abstractions that try to mimic the human brain that are being applied in AI, and anything promising on that front?
So maybe not. We think of the human brain as like this epitome, like system that's very like great for learning. I mean, yeah, it is. But like, it comes down to like the system recognizing certain interactions that you could almost say it's a binary interaction. Like the simplest type of perception is either it affects you or it doesn't. And, once something affects you, there's a reaction to act. And from there, I actually think that some of the most interesting work is coming from the work of Michael Levin, who basically uses bioelectricity, or kind of the way that organisms or cells can sense electricity, electrical signals, and change, without messing with their DNA. He's proven that you can insert certain electrical signals and change the morphology. Like, you can actually change from a single-headed worm, you change the electrical signals around it, and actually can grow two worms, and when they reproduce, the worms will the offspring will also have two heads. And the idea of that is really going into like what is a cancer cell. And the idea from that is a cell observes its environment, and depending on the level of stress, it has a certain force to really like try and survive. And if there's so much stress for the single cell, it will adapt and survive at any cost. But it also, like, if it's super stressed, it will survive at the cost to its external environment or the surrounding cells. And that's kind of what creates a cancer. And something that I'm really interested in is how can you apply that to a social level, in the sense where, you have very strenuous economic systems, and individuals all the way that are struggling financially, nutritionally, etc. And some people really survive from that, but they may do so at a very you know, to the detriment of not listening to their surrounding environment, which it could be their individual neighborhood or their country. And, you know, with that, you know, you can, I'm not going to call any individual a cancer. That's not the point. The point is really like, how can you change the signaling from individual cells or people so that way they can respond to the environment, or also communicate with the rest of the environment, so that where they're able to adapt and kind of aggregate into something that is less, you know, selfish and more more generous and more cohesive with the rest of the environment. And that goes not just from an individual in a poverty stricken place, but, you know, organizations, companies, and governments that, you know, they may have negative effects to their environment. And going with Gregory Bateson, he's a cyberneticist, he would say that, you know, the organism that destroys its environment, it destroys itself. And so if you think about how this kind of theory of cancer, where cancer is a very strenuous part on the system to where it starts acting out for its survival, forgetting to consider anything else about its environment. I wonder, I'm really curious, and I hope that AI can help with this through education, where we can start being more collaborative and assist in our communication across each other, you know, telling each other what we need and, you know, what is bothering us.
And are you aware of any efforts to build this type of model?
I think just really, Michael Levin is really at the foundation there with working on the cellular level or you know, small organismic level. But I do think that there is some theory in there where you can scale that up and apply it to kind of organisms in their environment, mm-hmm. for being more cohesive. Mm-hmm. I'm very curious, and I would love to like learn who's if there's anyone that is kind of studying that aspect. Mm-hmm.
But let's move back to the brain, though.
Yeah. Sure.
Which is so really the human brain, right, has evolved over millions of years. It has these modular structures like the hippocampus for memory and the cerebellum for motor control. Do you think AI development should take inspiration from this modularity? Or are, you know, developers of these models, are they better off pursuing their own separate design principles?
I definitely do think that we can learn a lot from observing the brain and observing organisms as well. The reason I kind of brought up that example is that you don't need to change, like you don't need to go so fine grain into modeling the whole system to change how it interacts. You just send a signal and then you just kind of trust that the rest of the organism will adapt in the way that you are expecting. And it comes down to just sending, the reward function for an AI, or the dopamine response in a brain for like, oh, I've done something good, and so I can continue doing that. And I think, thinking about the two different perspectives of like the negative reward versus a positive reward. Negative reward is like, oh yeah, I see that you're doing that, don't do that anymore. That's very constrained. Versus a positive reward is like, oh yeah, keep doing that. And there's, you know, if you think about how we maneuver in society, you are kind of happier when like, yes, you will have behaviors that you will engage with and you care to act. But if you just see the world as a bunch of walls that you can't enter, then everything is kind of closing in on you. Whereas if you just automatically want to do something without actually caring about, oh, I have all these walls in place, it's because you've been channeled in that direction. And I think in terms of AI and learning, we can create systems for not explicitly establishing kind of the walls or the rules of what you can't do, but it's more about kind of persuading or corralling an AI or an individual into something that's much more positive and being like, I can do this because I want to, as opposed to I'm doing this because I don't want this other thing.
Now, you brought up in your previous answer, you brought up the example of that research or theory, right, at the organism level. But is there any trend or development that's sort of sitting at this intersection of systems theory, biology, and AI that excites you, that gives you hope or concerns you?
I mean, definitely, I would say that Michael Levin's work is exciting to me. There's also, let me pull out this book. I've been reading this one called Cosmic Evolution by Eric Chasen, which is really a kind of a introductory book on that, where just showing that the world or the universe itself is evolving towards more complexity, from non-living matter to living matter to cities, and now we have spaceships going outside. There seems to be a trend, and I would say that part of that trend is through communication. And I think that one way to really help us is assisting our communication, which AI, through one way or another, whether that is making better code, which one detriment is making spaghetti code, but at the same time, that spaghetti code wouldn't have existed if that tool wasn't there. So we continually go up that ladder. So at some point, that spaghetti code may be moderately functional code, and then the people that are really advanced at coding will be able to make more advanced things because they don't need to manually write the boilerplate or do very specific planning of software architectures, because that's implied and it's within the context of the AI that is creating this this kind of this code base.
So Liminal, you've chosen to remain anonymous on social media and so on under the handle Liminal, as I just said. Is this a reflection of the name, right, the handle, a reflection of some philosophy, or is it more ad hoc?
I think it is reflective of some of my philosophy. Liminal is kind of being at the boundary of a transition. I imagine like a bubble where the moment that a needle is coming to the bubble and you can see it like about to pop, or you expect it to pop, or the liminal spaces where you just an image of an empty hallway. It's just these points of transition. And also liminal has a similar sound to luminal or luminosity, things that are light. And I thought that was an interesting connection, but I do like the idea of being in that transitory state, or like points in like right before a cascade of things to happen. I think these ideas are really interesting, and it points to something further. Maybe not explicitly when I came up with it, but I think that there's something deep down that I resonate with.
Yeah. Once you got liminal over you, you became subliminal.
Yeah.
Liminal, if there's one takeaway you hope listeners got from this conversation, what do you think it would be?
One takeaway. I'd say it's really just kind of moving towards more communication with other people. And even if others are in disagreement with you, it's the fact that you can interact with them and absorb their worldview is probably the most important thing, rather than being at complete odds with someone else and then closing off that realm of communication. And that, you know, everything, you know, for our perception, right? Our perception is contextual. And we are all interpreting the natural world through our perception. So there's still something underlying everything that you could call objective, but it's being interpreted in a multitude of ways.
Great. And so where can, well, actually, what are you working on these days, and where can people find your work?
Yeah. So I'm working with Git Citadel on Alexandria, where we are trying to create a decentralized knowledge base for individuals to post their knowledge. It can be something like a Wikipedia where there's not specific topics, or it can be focused knowledge bases. And it's a combination of personal note-taking and, you know, almost like a specialized collection of courses. And being on Noster, I hope it enables permissionless and decentralized education, where, you know, you can take these isolated and specialized topics, combine them, and synthesize something new, like taking a math knowledge base, a chemistry knowledge base, and biology knowledge base, combine that, and then bam, you have some research for, you know, computational biology. And you know, you can throw AI into that, where you take the individual notes and combine them for your own or the assistance of an AI to synthesize. Like, instead of a regular chat window, it's something that you can just compose out of a list of like little Lego blocks and can replace them in and out. So that way you can learn and you can also share it with someone else.
You know, I have to confess, Liminal, I've been remiss in not paying enough attention to Git Citadel and Alexandria. I've heard the name Alexandria come up a few times in the last month or so. And I will try to carve out some time to actually dig into it. This is my third podcast, so I am a little time poor right now. I'm also working on the sequel to my book. I'm balancing that with my day job. Oh, and all the vibe coding experiments that are happening on the side. No, but all of that to say that, you know, I've heard the name Git Citadel come up in the past, and then Alexandria is a project that keeps coming up on my social feed, especially in the last month or so. So I will carve out some time and give it the attention it deserves. But Liminal, I appreciate you being so generous with your time, so generous with your knowledge. Thank you for doing this. And I hope our audience will enjoy this as well if they're listening on the Fountain podcasting app.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. It was a great time. I appreciate just, you know, sitting with me. I hope that I was able to. So one of the things I'm most concerned with is like how much of the ideas am I transmitting that are affecting, like whether it's you or the audience. And so I hope I've distilled enough of it to be, you know, comprehensible.
It certainly is. And guess what, Liminal? The Fountain podcasting app has a neat little AI summary feature. Oh. So it transcribes the podcast, and I think, I don't know which model it uses behind the hood, but it actually produces a pretty cohesive summary of everything that was talked about. So, you know, wouldn't it be fitting that for an AI podcast, we use an AI summary tool to figure out what's going on?
Great.
All right. Well, thank you, And thank you all for listening.